We continue with the Epistle to the Romans, now to the 21st verse. Let love be genuine. Hate what is evil. Hold fast to what is good. Love one another with mutual affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. Do not lag in zeal, be ardent in spirit. Serve the Lord. Rejoice in hope. Be patient in suffering. Persevere in prayer. Contribute to the needs of the saints. Extend hospitality to strangers. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Do not claim to be wiser than you are. Do not repay anyone evil for evil, but take thought for what is noble in the sight of all. If it is possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. No, if your enemies are hungry, feed them. If they are thirsty, give them something to drink. For by doing this, you will heap burning coals on their heads. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. This too is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Join me, if you will, now in a word of prayer. Almighty, eternal God, grant now that the words of Hillary's, Michael's, and Van's mouths and the meditations of all of our hearts may be acceptable, even pleasing in your sight. O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. As is our custom, we have this year selected three members of the congregation to deliver homilies of their choosing about a core value that is important to them. In the Presbyterian tradition, we do not believe that the ordained clergy have the market cornered on the word of the Lord. Indeed, we believe that God speaks through many voices. Today, those voices come to us from Hillary and Michael and Van. We are grateful to God for you and for the word you will bring. And so, with nothing further, I will stand down so that you may stand up.
Morning. It's very difficult for me to be standing here this morning because this is what I know. I want to be sitting in that pew listening to Barron preach. I want to hear him preach about healing, hope, and love. I want to hear his words resonate with me like they did 4 years ago. In one of his sermons in October of 2012, Barron called us together as a community. We are a community of faith, living in a community in need of reconciliation. And we're called to be agents of reconciliation. Barron, thank you for giving us those words as they continue to resonate with me today. This I know. But today is this I Believe Sunday. And I must admit, when Barron asked me to be a part of the service, my hope was that he was just asking me to lead all of you in the reciting of the Apostles' Creed. Once I had a clear understanding and the panic sent in, I knew he was asking me to reflect and go deep. A few days later, I was sitting in the front pew listening to Barron's sermon as I had what I refer to as a Disney moment. I know, church, Disney. More specifically, I'm referring to Muppet Vision 3D. You know, where you're sitting in the theater wearing your special glasses, getting a tour of the lab containing the 3D machine, You watch as the machine goes awry, and a little blue creature flies out, bouncing on heads. Suddenly, he's directly in front of your face, and you get the sense that he's talking just to you. This often happens to me when listening to Barron. In this particular sermon, Barron was comparing faith to a river. Faith, like the river, takes time and exposure, he said. Depth doesn't come overnight. It comes with year in, year out, life together. He's talking to me, I thought. My faith journey is like a river. It has bends, ripples, and sometimes whitewater rapids. But the Bible says, "For by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not your own doing. It is the gift of God. This I believe." The definition of God's grace is unmerited favor. It is kindness from God that we don't deserve. There is nothing we have done, nor can ever do, to earn this favor. It is a gift from God. It is that favor, that kindness, that assures me that I'm not alone in this journey. This I believe. To quote Anne Lamott, God's everywhere. God's in the effort. God's in the struggle, whether that's for civil rights or creative expression. God's always in the struggle with us. When I think of effort, I think of trying to do what's right, trying to do God's will, fighting for what we believe, fighting for what is right, working for others. Together as a faith community, we as a congregation raise those efforts high. This I believe. Mission trips, developing strong programs for children and youth, feeding the homeless, raising awareness, embarking on capital campaigns that not only ensure our church home is welcoming and accessible to all, but also helps us to be responsible stewards of our finances and physical property. I have been blessed to be a part of these efforts. This I believe. God is also in the struggles, and sometimes the struggles come from within, springing forth like water overflowing the riverbanks. I know I try to be a good Christian, but sometimes I struggle. Sometimes I have doubts, fears. I ask a lot of whys. Sometimes I feel in my heart is a little less than love. How does this make me look in the eyes of God? What is expected of me? This brings me to another Muppet Vision 3D moment. One particular Sunday, my inner struggles were getting the better of me. In his sermon, Barron offered three ways to be on the right side of God's goodness and love, all of which I hold close today. One, he said, exercise a zero tolerance toward hate. Be the person whose principles your friends have to tolerate. Two, pretend to love people. He said that the world would be a better place because of it, and added that St. Paul says it has the added advantage of making your enemies crazy. Three, forgive. Yikes. Sometimes that's my biggest struggle. It takes a lot of effort, but God is in the effort. And with these tools and his grace, I know I'm not alone in navigating the challenges of rough waters. This I believe. While I grew up active in my church in DeWitt, New York, singing in the children's choir, playing the handbells, going to youth group every Sunday night, my faith journey really did not start flowing until joining Morningside over 20 years ago. As a much younger adult, a parent of two small children, it was here that I found my village. It was here where I really started listening. It is here where I began to see God's grace at work. To quote Anne Lamott again, my coming to faith did not start with a leap, but rather a series of staggers from what seemed like one safe place to another. Like lily pads, round and green, these places summoned and then held me up while I grew. Each prepared me for the next leaf on which I would land, and in this way I moved across the swamp of doubt and fear. I look out at all of you, my church family, my mother, and Jack and Annie, and see many lily pads. Whether the waters are calm or treacherous, you lift me up along this journey. It is because of you and God's grace that the depth of my river continues to grow. This I believe. Thank you.
Good morning. Baron, I'll be completely honest with you. When you asked me to be here, when I answered the call to be here, I had no earthly idea how imposing this pulpit could be. It really is. In fact, I think the last time that I delivered what one might call a sermon or a homily was back during the mid-90s when I was a teenager on Youth Sunday, as I'm sure many of you young adults have as well. Which also, I should mention, my parents also happen to be in town this weekend from the New Orleans area, fresh off the 50th anniversary of their church and of my church of origin, John Calvin Presbyterian Church back in Louisiana. 50 years. You know, a lot can happen to a church community in 50 years. You all know this here. But apparently not too many good Youth Sunday sermons, because unbeknownst to me, my parents bring me the program. This is a true story. This weekend when they come into town, and I'm listed in here as having given one of the top three best Youth Sunday sermons in 50 years, which is remarkable that there is actually someone recording and grading these Youth Sunday sermons. There were Sundays we couldn't even find an usher, so it's maybe it was my mom, I don't know. So make no mistake about it, there are some heavenly high expectations from the Laurie pew this morning. In any event, fast forward 20 years, obviously I'm here with you today, invited to speak on a core belief that has shaped my faith. One singular belief. Consider this for a minute, for more than just a brief second. What is that one thing, the one belief, the one tenet that has guided you through the doors of the sanctuary this morning? It may not be so immediately obvious. It certainly wasn't to me. We all have this profoundly unique human experience. What we believe today isn't necessarily what we believed yesterday. Faith, after all, is a journey. But I'd venture to say that each and every one of us has a guiding principle buried somewhere within us that has been our constant. And it's that guiding light which opens our hearts and opens our minds and bonds us together on this journey of faith. For me, it's the belief that God is always with me. This isn't an especially enlightening notion. I'm sure many of you are thinking, well, of course, God is always with us. Some of the first words of faith that we probably ever heard came during our baptisms when the preacher says, in the words of Jesus through Matthew, "Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, in the name of the Son, and in the name of the Holy Ghost, and teaching them to obey everything that I have commanded you. And remember, I am always with you, even to the end of the age." Now, it's one thing to say these words. It's another thing entirely to hear them, but it's especially meaningful and entirely wonderful to believe them. I believe that God is always with me. I don't think that. I believe that. Of course, it's easy to believe when things are going right, but when life doesn't go right, there's a great State Farm ad campaign out right now, perhaps you've seen it, that sort of contemplates this utopian world where nothing ever goes wrong. One of the ads begins abruptly with a farmer rushing toward his homestead as a tornado tears at him. A trampoline near the farmhouse is sent airborne by the rushing winds as the farmer uses both of his hands to cover his head. But before the tornado gets to him, it vanishes into a rainbow over the adjacent cornfields. A voice comes on and asks, "What if we woke up one day and everything stopped going wrong? No more accidents, no more fires, no more emergencies, no more bad anything." Of course, that's a scenario that none of us will ever know, but that's precisely the payoff of the ad campaign. Even in a world where nothing went wrong, they say, the insurance company is there to make life go perfectly right. God offers us this same insurance policy, but at a discount, like a really deep discount, and it's a lifelong policy. I reach out to God when things are right. I say thank you. I reach out to God when things aren't so right. I say please. But I also reach out to God when things are wrong, like horribly wrong. And it's in those days, it's on those days and in those moments that I don't say please and I don't say thank you. And it's taken me some time to realize that that's okay. It's okay to be frustrated with God. It's okay to even be mad at God. Because being frustrated or being mad with God only reaffirms my belief that God is always with me. It's not always sunshine, it's not always rainbows along our journey of faith, but a universal truth that I found is that the grace of God can handle the punches. God isn't fazed by my emotions because God is with me always, even in those emotions, as much as he is there for you. My fiance is an amazing woman, though sometimes she is fazed by my emotions. If God is always with me, then she's always been there for me. We've learned a lot about each other, but through each other, we've also learned a lot about ourselves. She has a huge passion for travel, almost an adventurous type passion. So if we're not here on a Sunday, it's probably because we're out somewhere adventuring. Last December, we were doing just that, sitting in a small passenger train compartment as we made our way from Casablanca to Fez, the second largest city in the North African country of Morocco. Our visit came only a few weeks after the coordinated Paris attacks, and during a period of intense political discourse back here at home on religion and immigration. It was, for lack of a better word, an educational time to be traveling in a predominantly Islamic country. As we sat quietly on this train with our fellow passengers, a gentleman seated directly across from us subtly looks down, glances at his phone, stands up, faces the large compartment window, silhouetted by the mid-afternoon sun, falls to both knees, and begins his afternoon prayers. For these two Westerners, these two Christians, it was a moment of certain recognition. For this man, among many things, it was a reminder of God's presence with him. We found it strangely peaceful, and though our theology may differ, it reflected a simple yet fundamental belief that felt more familiar than it did foreign. We do pray outwardly as Christians, but not enough. I'm the first to admit that I don't do enough outside of this sanctuary. In fact, during our premarital counseling with Drew, he told me and Kate that one of the most intimate, yet oddly awkward and uncomfortable things that we will do as a couple is to pray out loud together. Just the two of us. And you know, he's right. It's something that we're still working on. As the service opened this morning, before the first prayer, before the first hymn, we heard, "The Lord be with you." "And also with you," we replied. God is with you in all that you do. God is also with me. This I believe, and this I know.
My last semester of college, I suddenly fell into a depression. There was no real reason for it. And in fact, I had every reason to be happy. I was about to graduate. I was moving to a new city and a new job. I had even started a relationship with a wonderful woman that I thought, rightly, as it turned out, that I might one day marry. And, you know, I started to think about my future, to kind of imagine these possible paths of where I might one day live, what I might do, the family that I might have. And these paths varied widely, winding this way and that. But the thing about imagining your future is that every path ultimately ends in the same place, which is death. Not that I hadn't ever thought about mortality before, but for whatever reason, it struck me so deeply in this moment, becoming a fixation. I would even, you know, skip my classes and just sit in my room thinking about death, you know, working it over in my mind like Billy Crystal's character at the start of When Harry Met Sally, when he's berating Meg Ryan over her happiness. And he says, "Have you ever thought about death?" "Oh, sure you do, a fleeting thought that jumps in and out of the transom of your mind. I spend hours. I spend days. I was scared. Whenever I closed my eyes, I saw myself falling eternally into darkness." But no, not even that. Not even darkness. Nothing at all. Becoming nothing as if I had never been. Now, I'm a journalist by training, and I love nothing more than a good fact, but there was nothing concrete about death. No way of knowing, of blanketing this fear with rationalism. Religion offered me no comfort either. I had been raised in my mom's Methodist church, but when I was in high school, my hometown pastor suddenly became very virulently anti-gay. And as much as I wanted to believe and to belong, I just couldn't imagine myself a part of something so hateful. I visited several churches during college, but I found a home in none, so while I still hoped for some afterlife, I didn't have faith that one waited for me. So I'm in the depths of this, and my dad calls. He has a question or an invitation, really. He's going on a road trip, and he wants some company. Did I want to go ghost hunting? Now, I realize that most of you don't know Tim Jensen, DDS, but I assure you my father is the most rational-minded person that I know, not particularly given to flights of fancy, a Lutheran through and through. And yet, the invitation stood. So my dad was not just after any ghost. He was after a particular ghost. In our family, she is really the ghost of my great-great-great-grandmother, Joanna. So now we need to go on a quick detour down the family tree. So my great-grandmother, Olive Ollie Fisher, who was about a 4 foot tall, no-nonsense red-headed woman, and she in her later years, she became very driven to trace the family genealogy. This eventually became a nearly 500-page volume that stretches back centuries across the Atlantic. And a large part of the impetus behind this research was Joanna Thomas, which is Ollie's grandmother. So here's what we know. Joanna was born in Wales in 1835. She lost her mother at a young age and immigrated to the United States with her father and sister. In 1861, she married Robert Marion West. So Robert was kind of a vagabond, never really holding a job or staying in one place for long. Joanna was his second wife. They would go on to have three children, eventually moving to southeastern Kansas. And it was there that on October 19th, 1876, Joanna died of pneumonia. Her daughter, Mary, and this is great-grandma Ollie's mother, was 7 at the time. Robert packed up and moved the family back east where he married yet again. And later, the West family moved a final time to a farm in western Nebraska. There, my family stayed. Mary never could remember exactly where her mother's grave was. Eventually, she put a headstone up in a cemetery in Nebraska. Joanna became a mythical figure in family lore, this sort of tragic matriarch lost to history. For great-grandma Ollie, Joanna bordered on an obsession. She was driven to find this true grave, but she never did. The task then passed on to her daughter, my grandma Doreen, and then to my father. And for years, they had searched and searched and searched and found nothing. But then, recently, they found a new clue. So on a trip through Utah, my parents had visited the Family History Library in Salt Lake City. The library holds the greatest store of genealogical data in the world, assembled for a somewhat unusual purpose. The Church of Latter-day Saints holds that families can be reunited in the afterlife, but only through what's called sacred sealing ceremonies. These temple rites can be performed by proxy for those who have already died, as long as the priests know the identity of the person for whom it is that they're praying. So this vast team of Mormon volunteers scours records all across the globe to find everyone that they can living or dead, to offer them entrance into life eternal. 3 billion souls and counting. So at the library, my dad searches the database for information around Independence, Kansas, where we've always believed it was that, that Robert and Joanna had lived. But once again, Dad finds nothing. But on a whim, he says, let me look just one county over. And there, he comes across an 1875 agricultural survey that lists Robert West and his family as living as tenants near the town of Sedan, Kansas. That must have been where Joanna died. And it was there that we would go hunting. So Dad pulls up to my rental house in Lincoln, Nebraska, early on a fall morning. He's driving his old green Ford Explorer. So we head south towards Kansas, and I did as best I could to mask my precarious mental state. But I remember stopping for gas along the way, and I set out to clean the windshield. And a monarch butterfly had smashed against the vehicle, its body battered. And as I watched, its wings slowly opened and closed once, twice, and then never again. And squeegee still in my hand, I started sobbing and had to run to the men's room until I managed to pull the mask back over my fragility. So we continue driving. We pull into Independence, Kansas, which is going to be the home base for our hunt. And the small city is decorated for its annual fall festival. There are banners hanging from buildings and utility poles advertising the name of the festival, which is Niwala. So my dad grins at me, and he asks if I understand the name. So, you know, my dad, he loves a good puzzle. So I start to look at this, you know, Niwala, and try to decipher it, try to unlock the secret of it. I start to get a little bit annoyed. I say, no, and I'm kind of grated at being stumped. I don't know, is it some kind of, I don't know, Native American word? And Dad just grins a little wider, just kind of delighting in my aggravation. He says, keep trying. You'll get it. And we're driving along, and I see, you know, sign after sign, Niwala, 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 and I'm just getting more and more aggravated as I look, and it never really amounts to anything other than so much gibberish. Dad just, every once in a while, did you get it yet? So the next day, we went into the county courthouse, and previously, my dad had come down to the city with my mom, and he thought that he knew the right cemetery, but on this trip, our purpose was really to rule out any other possibilities. So we go to the courthouse, and we pull out every map that we can historically to find every cemetery that has ever existed in this place. So then we start to go out to them. One by one, these abandoned burial sites were, you know, climbing barbed wire fences and tromping through sunflower fields and then hacking away the underbrush, sweating under the sun, just searching each name, looking for Joanna's name, but we never find it. And most of the cemeteries aren't even old enough for it to have been possible that she would have been buried there. It was hard work, but I lost myself in it. And it really, it allowed me to connect with my dad in a way that I never had. We talked about Cornhusker football and movies, and I tried in vain to get him to understand my love for hip-hop. And as the sun faded on the prairie, he told me more about the ghost. My great-grandma Ollie wasn't just fixated on Joanna. She was haunted. Ollie dreamed incessantly of Joanna, dreamed a vision of her grave so specific that she could describe it in great detail. On a gentle hill just above a river bend, a large tree casting shade over it. One hot summer night, Ollie awoke to find the air in her bedroom ice cold, condensation forming on the wall. Joanna appeared before her, demanding that Ollie find her and bring her peace. The dreams passed on to my grandma Doreen, and my dad had had them as well. He described one to me that had struck him with such lucidity, this vision of his own death, and then a reunion with Ollie, with Joanna, with all the family. At night, Dad and I would go back to Independence to eat and talk some more and rest. And Of course, as we go, he keeps pointing to those signs. Did you get it yet? I hadn't. I couldn't. The harder I tried, the farther away it seemed, the bigger this mystery became, and I was so damned annoyed. But I couldn't wrap my brain around. So, the next day, we had ruled out every other cemetery, so we go back to our work, and my dad says it has to be this one cemetery just a little north of Sedan. So my dad tells me the last time he had come, he had found a record of specifically where Joanna and Robert had lived, and it's just right next to this one cemetery. So let's go look for it. It's the St. Charles Cemetery, which we got to by driving out of town, eventually turning off of a paved road onto this rutted dirt track, dipping down through a rocky stream bed, moving so slow so the explorer wouldn't become stuck, and then up onto a grassy hill where the small cemetery sat behind a fence, a tall tree casting afternoon shade across it. Dad didn't even have to say it. This was just as Great-Grandma Ollie had described. At one edge of the cemetery rested a series of headstones from the early 1870s, and then a gap until another headstone from 1881. And between them, a single grave marked not by a headstone, but by three pieces of red sandstone set in order, a Welsh tradition. If there had been any markings, they'd long since eroded away. And Dad told me the first time he'd come here, he brought a video camera. And it worked just fine as he recorded the rest of the cemetery. But he turns it to this grave, and it turns off. And so he gets annoyed, and he goes back to his vehicle, and all of a sudden the camera turns on again. But then when he goes back to this one unmarked plot to record it, the camera turns off a second time. We'd gone down to rule out other possibilities, and so we had. Still, there was no way of knowing for certain, no hard, rational proof. But my dad smiled. He had found it. He had found her, Joanna. He had faith. Back in Independence, Dad commissioned a new granite tombstone, which would be installed later. And as we headed out of town back toward our lives, I realized that amid all the searching, the excitement of the hunt, my depression had faded, had disappeared. I had been too busy for anxiety, but returning to the normalcy of my life, would I fall back into that fear? It felt as inevitable as death. And just then, Dad decides to pull me out of my wallowing. We were at the edge of town, and that sort of devilish grin returns to his face. He says, "Well, did you get it?" We had this wonderful trip together, and there he was pestering me with Niwala all over again. I had had enough. I snapped at him. "No, I didn't, okay. I couldn't figure out. What is it? What is it? What does it mean?" Dad pointed to the passenger side mirror. I looked in it. There, I saw one of the Niwala signs reflected back at me, its letters reversed in the mirror image. "Do you understand?" he asked. I saw it clearly. It was so simple, so stupidly simple. There was no great revelation. If you take Niwala and spell it backwards, it says Halloween. So as the absurdity and silliness of it washed over me, I understood that another puzzle had been staring at me, taunting me, teasing me at a great truth that ever escaped me. And while I still hadn't solved this riddle, not yet, I did find an answer, a revelation of sorts. And once again, this answer was so stupidly simple, the kind of thing you'd find inside a fortune cookie. And that revelation is this: in this world, and whatever lies beyond, there are some things that you simply cannot understand until they're behind you.